Hey everyone, and welcome to Sincerely Letty. I'm your host, Letty Shoemate, here to bring you truth and knowledge about history, racial justice, and more to help you connect the dots and see the bigger picture that is so necessary in our society today. Welcome back for season 4 of Sincerely Letty. If you can't tell, super excited. It has been 2 months since I have recorded a podcast episode. I'm glad to be back. Needed the 2 month break. Was really supposed to be just like a month break, but you know what? Something was like, you need to take another month off. Glad that I did. So anyway, a lot has happened in the last 2 months. A lot has happened in the country. A lot has happened for me. And I'm not going to go into all the things that have happened in America since the middle of May, but I will say that we are right now in a time of, the word awakening always sounds so romanticized, but we are in a time right now where change is happening, where more people are listening. To be quite honest, I'm over here like, I've been screaming Black Lives Matter since the Black Lives Matter movement started, but glad to see that more people are truly and genuinely giving a damn about us now. Also, there's a lot of performative crap going on, as we know. There's a lot that's being done for, like, you know, optics and all that stuff. But anyway, not going to get on that soapbox right now. But I will say that now is not the time to lose momentum. Now is the time to be on your anti-racism journey. And if you haven't started the journey, I need for you to start because there's no damn excuses. None. We're out here trying to dismantle white supremacy, dismantle racism. You need to call out your racist family members, your racist friends, your racist co-workers. What? It's uncomfortable? Too bad. I'm uncomfortable all the time in white America. So, have you done any of that yet? Why not? What are you waiting for? Are you scared? Well, you got to get over that. Because Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter. It's not a trend. It's not a one-time thing. It isn't something to just pick up and put back down whenever you get ready. Mm-mm. That's not what this is. Okay? It's not a hashtag on Instagram or on Facebook where you use it just because your friends were using it at the time. And now that they're not saying it anymore, then you aren't going to say it no more. Okay? It is not the time to think that you can pick and choose the work that you want to do. Mm-mm. The work must always be done. It's critical. It's integral. It's non-negotiable. Because when you look at history, and people want to talk about how changes always happen, but what you don't want to talk about is the sacrifices that are required to get to the change. And I don't mean the big change, because that takes time. I mean the small things that people don't even see happening, right? That's where the change starts. So yeah, that's how I'm starting season 4. So if that's any indication of how the season's going to go, yeah, there you have it. Before I do go any further, because I should have said this at the beginning, whoops. This week's episode is all about a Black woman who was such a huge name in Mississippi's freedom movement during the Civil Rights Movement. And her name was June Johnson. I'm going to tell you a story about June. I'm also, of course, going to connect her to other things that were happening that you may have heard about, even if you haven't heard about her. So, I'm excited. But before I jump in and talk about June Johnson, I do want to talk to y'all about my Patreon. So if you do not know what Patreon is, it is a way for you to support the work of people like myself. So on my Patreon page, I provide, of course, history education and anti-racism content. So my tiers range from $5 a month to $100 a month. You decide where you can fit in, okay? And with each podcast episode that I do on my Patreon, you'll be able to access even more content that goes along with the podcast episodes for $5, y'all. And this includes, like, for example, with June Johnson, on my Patreon page, you will be able to access a document that has a link to an interview with June Johnson from 1987. Yeah, you'll also be able to like access a couple of other links that have primary sources in them so you can like see actual documents from the time, right? From the 60s with the Freedom Project summer, which you're going to learn about in this episode. And that kind of stuff is just so important because whenever you see the actual history, you're able to be like, wow, like it doesn't seem so quote-unquote long ago, because people want to say that all the time. Like, oh, it was so long ago. No, it wasn't. It wasn't a long time ago. So anyway, I'll go over my tiers real quick. But my $5 tier, once again, well, it goes from $5 to $100. Stokely is my $5 tier for Stokely Carmichael. My $10 tier is Shirley Chisholm. And that is where you will be able to access a Q&A webinar once a month and my general Patreon webinar once a month. So that's two webinars already right there, okay? My Angela Davis tier, yes, I have a tier name for Angela Davis, is my $15 tier. And you'll be able to get lessons with Letty every month, weekly. And you'll also be able to access a webinar where we go over that every month and the general Patreon webinar. And everything in the Stokely tier. Then I have a James Baldwin tier. You can access everything, absolutely everything, okay? Because if you go on there and you look, certain tiers that I just mentioned don't get access to everything, okay? Then you have the Maya Angelou tier. Yes, Maya, for $50. And that is a book club, y'all. You'll get access to a private Facebook group. We'll have a webinar every month. You'll get access to everything that I mentioned just now before. Angela Davis tier, Shirley tier, Stokely tier, like all of that. And then the $100 tier is Toni Morrison, and you access all of the things. You have the opportunity every other month to possibly get a book if I draw your name and you're part of that tier. You also get an extra Q&A webinar every month. Y'all, there's just a lot. There's a lot. So get on my Patreon and check that stuff out. I will have the link in the show notes. It's patreon.com/Letty Shoemate. I am going to take this opportunity to tell everyone that has already signed up to support me via Patreon, thank you so much. Y'all, and I'm going to say this for about 30 seconds. I was overwhelmed with the people who started following me, supporting me, encouraging me, like, the last couple months. I mean, it happened overnight, and I was, like, I was crying at one point, not because I was sad, but because I was just so happy, right? I was just so happy to know that what I'm doing is impacting people so much, because this is my purpose, this is my passion, like, this is what I love to do, and so thank you for your constant support. Thank you for sharing my posts on Instagram, on Facebook. Like, thank you for like listening to my IG lives and all my rants that I do. And just thank y'all, because yeah. So anyway, there's the Patreon spiel. And now let's get into June Johnson. June Elizabeth Johnson was born in 1947 in Greenwood, Mississippi. And she was born actually just a few miles away from where 14-year-old Emmett Till's body was found 8 years later. Okay, because Emmett Till was murdered in 1955. So I tell you that to give you some context of where she was born and where she grew up. Even as a child, June felt a lot of frustration, like seeing her parents afraid of talking openly about white supremacy in Mississippi and the South. And she decided early on that she wanted to find a way to fight it. And actually, before I get more into June and who she was, let me tell you about the Mississippi Delta during this time. Okay, so let's just bring in some more historical context, because whenever I talk about history, I also talk about what was happening in America, because things don't happen in a vacuum and nothing in history is ever isolated. Never ever. Okay. So, Greenwood, Mississippi was one of the largest cotton processing centers in the Mississippi Delta. Okay. 800,000 bales of cotton pass through Greenwood, Mississippi each year. Yes, still, whenever, like, June was born. I'm not talking pre-1865, okay? Black people made up about half of the city's population and were the vast majority in the surrounding countryside, working mostly as sharecroppers and agricultural laborers on white-owned land, though, okay? For the most part, the work was still plantation style. But under the urging of the White Citizens Council, if you don't know what the White Citizens Council was, is, I highly advise you to Google that. But under the White Citizens Council, landowners were starting to bring in machines to replace and displace black people who worked on white-owned land. All right. What does that mean? Well, that means that black people were started getting evicted from where they were. And also, this happened around the same time whenever the civil rights movement was starting to like slightly gain momentum. With the rise of the freedom movement in Mississippi and this like increased awareness among black people of not putting up with the bullshit anymore, there was this demand for quote unquote Negro removal. And it was the strategy of Mississippi's white power structure. So between 1950 and 1960, around 200,000 black people were forced to leave the Mississippi Delta. And by 1964, the number of black sharecroppers was roughly half of what it was 6 years earlier. Most of the black people who were forced off of their land, like off of the land, they migrated to cities in the north. Now, when I say that too, have to know and understand that migrating to the north by 1950s and 1960s meant that you were migrating to what America began to call urban ghettos, because white flight was continuously happening in northern and also western cities. Black people who still remained in Mississippi, because a lot still remain there, obviously. But they endured like a lot of poverty, tons of racism, tons of white supremacy, like tons of oppression. And according to the 1960 census, the annual median income for rural black people in the Mississippi Delta was just $452. That equals to about $3,800 in 2020 America. On average, white children in the Mississippi Delta received 10 years of public schooling at the time, black children received less than 5 years because their schools were so ill-equipped that, like, so few of them were accredited. Yeah. Real life. Mm-hmm. And throw in segregation and how it was just absolute. And there was no talk of integration. And I'm going to reiterate that because Brown versus Board of Education, right? People think that that cured segregation in schools. That did not. Matter of fact, I'm going to take this moment to do a slight plug. In my Lessons with Letty for this month, there's week two, which is all about Brown versus Board and the lie that you're told about Brown versus Board and how it actually did not fix segregation. Mm-mm, that didn't happen. So if you want to know more about that, you can access that tier on my Patreon. Like anything Angela and up, you can access that information. Anyway. But yeah, so that paints a picture for you of what was going on in Mississippi. And I do mean a slight picture. I could do an entire episode just on what the Mississippi Delta looked like between 1946 or 1947, whenever June was born, and 1964. Oh, and Greenwood, Mississippi was located in LaFleur County, okay? And as of 1947, only 26 of this county's eligible 39,000 black residents were registered to vote. 26. Only 26 were registered to vote. And I'm going to talk in a little bit about how the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee started a voter registration project in Greenwood about 15 years later after June Johnson was born. So, June first heard about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and from here on, I will refer to this as SNCC, okay? So, she first heard about SNCC from a flyer that was given to her at a local church. And she snuck to voter registration workshops in the evenings while her parents were at work. Learning of this, her parents were reluctant about allowing her to participate in any kind of movement activity, which meant primarily canvassing potential black voter registrants. So, of course, this is going to be something where her parents are like, I don't know about this, because of the dangers that came with it. Like, black people in the South doing voter registration drives. Oh, white people were big mad about this. And I do mean big mad as in big mad, we're going to kill you. We're going to bomb your house. We're going to, the Klan is going to come. Yes, that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about. So, what happened, though, was there was a man named Bob Moses, okay? And Bob Moses was one of the leaders of SNCC in Greenwood, Mississippi. He was able to convince June Johnson's parents to allow her to continue her movement work. By this time, June was 14, 15 years old in high school. And when her involvement with Greenwood's emerging movement began in 1962, it had become a voter registration project. Bob Moses, the black man who I previously mentioned, he sometimes walked her to school to make sure that she attended classes, because as her passion for the movement grew, she wanted to spend her time going around trying to get black people registered to vote. She thought that that was more important than her getting an education. And I'm saying that because it shows you her passion. It shows her drive. It shows just how early her activism started and how even though she knew the dangers were out there, she still did it anyway. As a matter of fact, June's early activism even pulled her parents into the movement. Like, she even inspired them. And her mother and father, her mother's name was Lula Bell, her father's name was Theodore Johnson, they actually opened their home to SNCC workers often. I mean, often June's mom, Mrs. Johnson, was cooking food and providing plates and all of this, like, you know, feeding these activists who were going to later be revered as faces of the movement in Greenwood, Mississippi. Theodore Johnson, her dad, often would sleep on the floor so that anyone who needed to stay at their house could stay. Because what you also have to understand about SNCC was that it was a national organization. But there were different chapters in different cities or towns in different states. Over the next 2 years, so from 1962 to 1964, the Voter Registration Project became one of SNCC's most vital projects. The organization even temporarily moved its headquarters, okay, to Greenwood, Mississippi, for the, and you probably heard of this before, or maybe you haven't, but now you will, for the 1964 Freedom Summer Project. Sure, y'all have heard of Freedom Summer, right? But did you know that most of it happened in Greenwood, Mississippi, where June Johnson was? Yeah, I told y'all, she's somebody that you need to know. While I'm on the 1964 Freedom Summer Project, let me just tell y'all some more about what that was. So in 1963, violence aimed at halting the civil rights struggle in Mississippi was intensifying. And I mean intensifying as in extreme white violence. Black people being beat to death, children, teenagers, adults being brutalized, sexually abused. I mean, all kinds of stuff was happening because racism, white supremacy, and evil. And the federal government continued its reluctance to intervene at all. And don't even get me started on the local government. Especially the cops. They were the ones out here doing the beating, doing the brutalizing, doing the murdering, doing the sexual assaulting and raping of black women out in public, in jails. Yes. Mm-hmm. Hashtag defund the police for real in 2020 America. But anyway, moving forward, most of the nation was largely unaware of what was even happening in Mississippi. And not just Mississippi, y'all. This is how it was everywhere, okay? People didn't know what was really going on. I mean, if you lived in the South, you definitely knew. But if you're in Greenwood, Mississippi, you don't really know all that's happening in Atlanta, Georgia, right? Like, there wasn't just TV with coverage all the time. There weren't iPhones and Androids where you can just look and see a video of what's happening like across the country and you just have like live coverage to things. That's not what was happening. And I always explain this part too because it's really easy whenever you look at history to think about things in the same context of how we see things today and what happens today. And it's and that actually takes away from grasping the monumentous efforts that were made to like push change forward during this time. Because of all of this, the Council of Federated Organization, which is also known as COFO, that's how I'll refer to it from here on, and also COFO was first formed in 1961 to support the jailed Freedom Riders, and SNCC had the largest number of staff workers in COFO. But anyway, yeah, so COFO decided to bring attention to what was happening in Mississippi. And what did this bring from white America? Oh, of course, immense outrage. Of course. So before the summer started, the number of state troopers doubled. The state legislature passed dawn-to-dusk curfews, and the Klan numbers expanded. You had crosses burning in lawns everywhere. I mean, and I saw a number one time where it was like 64 of the state's 82 counties had crosses burning on a single night. And the 10 weeks that comprised the long, hot summer centered around several different goals, okay? So to establish freedom schools and community centers throughout the state, to increase Black voter registration, and to ultimately challenge the all-white delegation that would represent the state at the Democratic National Convention in August. So all this is happening in Greenwood, Mississippi, okay, in 1963, 1964. But because it's happening right and written about during this time, don't think that it wasn't happening before, all right? So you have to understand that it was just extremely intensified by this point. Bob Moses, the project director, had no grand, like, hope, actually, for the summer project. Like, he didn't know what they would really be able to accomplish. But he did say, and I quote, "Maybe we're not going to get many people registered this summer. Maybe, even, we're not going to get very many people into freedom schools. Maybe all we're going to do is live this summer. And in Mississippi, that will be so much." Freedom Summer included more than 44 projects grouped by congressional districts across the state. These projects range in size and scope. And, I mean, for example, Hattiesburg had more than 50 volunteers and staff, while some projects had as few as 2 workers. Most projects built upon existing movement activity and relationships with local Black leaders. Other aspects of the summer project, like the establishment of freedom schools, marked this new element, okay, in the Mississippi movement. In a state where funding for white schools sometimes quadrupled the amount spent on Black schools, remember those numbers I said at the beginning of this, all but 3 summer projects had freedom schools, y'all. Like, that's amazing. Workshop-style courses went from things like reading and math, civics, I mean, history, and by history, I mean Black history, and even history about modern Africa at the time. And this summer project made it possible for Mississippi's movement to expand into areas of the state that had experienced little civil rights activity in the past. I mean, again, just to reiterate here, talking about Greenwood, Mississippi. All right, you're talking about a place where, like I said earlier, Emmett Till's body was found just a few miles away in 1955. By the end of Freedom Summer in 1964, there had been 6 known murders, 35 known shootings, 4 people critically wounded, at least 80 volunteers beaten, and more than 1,000 people arrested. Except for the case of the 3 civil rights movement workers who were killed by the Klan. And if you don't know that story, I want you to Google that. The FBI failed to take any further action when it came to state violence towards civil rights workers in local communities. Surprised? You shouldn't be. This is why in 2020, when we see protests happening, okay, and we're screaming about the lack of the government to do a damn thing about it, and we're screaming about police and police brutality and ICE, okay? This is why, y'all, it's nothing new. There's nothing new about it at all. But like Ta-Nehisi Coates said, it's just the cameras that are new. But for many of the volunteers and activists during this summer, it marked the beginning of this life for them that was dedicated to social justice. And more than 200 of them decided to stay in Mississippi at the end of the summer. In the midst of all that was going on, y'all, they decided to stay in Mississippi. And some of them even quit their jobs or dropped out of school, though, to still fight this fight. And as a state, Mississippi became bigger in national news. And also, we're talking about 1964 and this Freedom Summer. You have to remember that 1964, okay, is also the year, not summer, whenever the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed by then President Lyndon B. Johnson. That's why I'm telling y'all, nothing happens in a vacuum with history. It's all connected. So can you imagine what was going on in the country? Yeah, fool yeah. And now that I explained the Freedom Summer and that project of 1964, which truly began in 1962, I'm gonna go back to June Johnson because I need to tell y'all what happened to her in June of 1963. On June 9th, 1963, June Johnson and a group of SNCC workers were returning from a voter registration training workshop in Charleston, South Carolina. Fannie Lou Hamer, and if you don't know who she is, y'all, she was a bold and fierce Black woman of the Civil Rights Movement. Whew, yes, Google her. But she was actually like the one leading them, okay? Well, they tried, whenever they were coming back from the training in Charleston, to Mississippi, they tried to sit in the front of their Trailways bus. Whenever the driver protested, they demanded that the driver's name be told to them. They told him that they would file a complaint with the bus company. And at each stop along the way, the driver stepped away to make a phone call. Okay, so anytime the bus stopped, here he was getting off the bus, calling somebody. Well, again, understand that June Johnson was 16 years old. When they arrived in Winona, June, Fannie Lou Hamer, and other civil rights workers sat on the white side of the waiting room. Well, whew, that was another huge no. But they were protesting and they refused to just allow Jim Crow laws and allow white supremacy and racism to tell them what they were not about to do. And also know that they knew what was going to happen to them. They knew what could happen, but they did it anyway. And also, just for context, go back for a second. Winona, Mississippi was about 30 miles, okay, from Greenwood, Mississippi. I'm actually going to read to you from a book called At the Dark End of the Street: Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. It's by Danielle McGuire, but there's a part in the book that goes into a lot of detail about what happened whenever Fannie Lou Hamer and June Johnson and others refused to give up their seats in the waiting room. Okay, so book says, police arrested Hamer and her companions for attempting to desegregate the bus terminal's lunch counter and drove them to the local jail. The county sheriff met the Black women at the door. "I've been hearing about you Black sons of bitches over in Greenwood, raising all that hell," he said. "You come over here to Winona, you'll get the hell whipped out of you." He was not kidding. Once in custody, each activist received a savage and sexually abusive beating by the Winona police. Officers first assaulted and sexually humiliated June Johnson, a beautiful and statuesque 16-year-old. Everyone in the jail must have heard Johnson's screams and the thumps of fists and boots hitting flesh as policemen yelled, "We're going to teach you how to say yes, sir, to a Mississippi white man." According to Hamer, Fannie Lou Hamer, the officers tore off most of her clothes and then forced her to strip off the rest as they watched. This is June Johnson that she's talking about. Johnson's co-workers gasped when whenever they saw her naked, bloody body and bulging eye as she stumbled back to her cell. Officers then brutalized Anel Ponder, a coordinator for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and organizer of the trip. Three policemen took turns viciously beating her with a blackjack, belt, fists, and open palms while berating her for not showing racial deference. "I want to hear you say yes, sir, nigger," one officer yelled repeatedly. "They really wanted to make me say yes, sir," Ponder recalled, "and that is the one thing I wouldn't say." When the police finished pounding Ponder, they directed their fury at Fannie Lou Hamer. Hamer, a stocky, church-going woman with a powerful singing voice, had worked as a field secretary for SNCC since B.D. Marlowe, her former employer and plantation owner in Sunflower County, fired her for registering to vote in the fall of 1962. Sunflower was home to both Parchman Penitentiary, and Senator James O. Eastland, both notorious symbols of white supremacy. Hamer and her husband, Pap, had worked on Marlowe's plantation for 18 years, but once she stepped outside the narrow confines of Jim Crow, Marlowe kicked her off his land and notified the local White Citizens Council, which harassed her and Pap relentlessly. Unable to find a job, she became an organizer for SNCC. The book goes on to talk about what Fannie Lou Hamer was doing as far as activism. And I'll pick up here where the book says, Hamer concentrated her efforts in Greenwood, home of the White Citizens Council and the center of SNCC's Delta activities. Her leadership inspired working people scarred by poverty and racism, but it also made her a constant target of intimidation, harassment, and sexualized violence. And now let's go back to the book is going to pick up where they were in the jail being beat in 1963, where her and June Johnson and others were. "You bitch," one officer yelled. "We going to make you wish you was dead." He ordered two black inmates to beat Hamer with a wide, long blackjack, while other patrolmen battered her head and other parts of her body. As they ruthlessly beat her, Hamer felt them repeatedly pull my dress over my head and try to feel under my clothes. When she attempted to pull her dress down in order to, as she put it, preserve some respectability through the horror and disgrace, a white officer walked over, took my dress, pulled it up over my shoulders, leaving my body exposed to five men. Hamer found out later that Lawrence Guyot, a civil rights activist who came to the Winona jail to inquire about the women's status, was arrested and sexually tortured as well. "They forced me to take off my pants," Guyot remembered, "and they threatened my testicles with burning sticks." Hamer was sure her attackers were sadists. She remembered their facial expressions during her beating and believed they displayed pleasure that was sexual in nature. Again, that was from the book At the Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power by Danielle L. McGuire. And I know that was hard to listen to, but y'all, I don't shy away from that history, because that I just read to you is what happened countless times in this country whenever black people were fighting for our rights that we're still fighting for. As word of the arrests of these SNCC workers, including June Johnson, spread, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference leader, Andrew Young, tried to get the FBI and the Justice Department into action, but this was to no avail. Oh, and I forgot to mention this about Lawrence Guyot, who went to the jail and then he was beaten with gun butts and stripped naked and threatened, like sexually threatened. Eventually, a doctor warned the cops that they were close to killing him. And you know what the sheriff turned around and did? He arrested Lawrence Guyot for attempted murder. The hell sense does that make? SNCC alerted supporters around the nation to immediately call the Montgomery County Sheriff and Winona police about the prisoners so that the cops knew that they were under public scrutiny. The next day, June the 10th, 1963, more SNCC activists reached Winona, and one of them managed to get into the jail where Anell Ponder was being held. After 3 days, though, Andrew Young, who again was the Southern Christian Leadership Conference leader, he managed to bail Lawrence Guyot and other SNCC workers, including June Johnson, out of jail and got them the desperately needed medical attention they just desperately needed it. I know that sounds redundant, but it's just, every time I read about this and read about anything like this, Fannie Lou Hamer, though, actually never fully recovered from her injuries. She suffered from damage to her kidneys, and she lost partial sight in one of her eyes for the rest of her life. And while they sat in jail, y'all, Medgar Evers was murdered. Medgar Evers was a civil rights activist in Mississippi, and he was murdered June the 12th, 1963. And June Johnson, right? Like, she knew who Medgar Evers was. And all of these things, though, all the things that happened to her, including her being near death from being beaten and sexually brutalized, all of this just strengthened her commitment. She actually said one time, "I didn't care what happened to me. I was going to be free or continue to be a part of a struggle to fight for the freedom of people of this country." And even after this, in June of 1963, June Johnson went on to organize both the Greenwood Voters League, and she worked with the MFDP. And the MFDP was the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. During a SNCC reunion in April 1988 at Trinity College, June Johnson, I'm going to read all of this to y'all, but she said, "Growing up in Mississippi, I never had the opportunity to have a summer vacation. My vacation was either cleaning some white person's house or going to chop cotton in the Mississippi Delta. That was the gist of my summer activities before my getting involved with SNCC. And it was a sense of frustration growing up. We heard about the Emmett Till situation and really didn't understand a lot of what happened other than the fact that a black boy had been castrated, murdered, and thrown into the Tallahatchie River. There was not a lot of conversation based on our parents' fear. They wanted to continue to live and survive within that community. And I saw additional things happen, not just outside of my family, but directly to my family, my mother in particular, who was, by the way, very active in SNCC and kept everybody very healthy. I think Guyot and Julian and Judy Richardson and Dory and many others ate pieces of her cornbread because she was the cook for SNCC. And I think as a result of my going to jail in 1963 in Winona and coming out, learning that Medgar had been killed after being beaten very badly in the Winona jail and having to suffer and see the suffering of Mrs. Hamer, I made a commitment to myself from that day. I didn't care what happened to me. I was going to be free or continue to be a part of a struggle to fight for the freedom of people of this country. And when I walked out of jail in 1963, I knew nothing else. And I had not done anything else in my life but struggle from the time that I got involved in the movement in Mississippi. And one of the biggest enjoyments that I've ever had in my life is to have met those persons that came to my hometown and taught me to become a first-class citizen. And I take this opportunity to say to each of you, I am appreciative of that, and I'm glad that you taught me how to fight for the rights of those who cannot fight for themselves. She still had that fierce spirit. I mean, I want you to just think for a minute. You were 16 years old, and you were almost beat to death in a jail, in a city, in a state that was in a country, right? That was plagued with and seeping with white supremacy. And whew, I mean, honestly, y'all, just think about that. And I mean, really think about it beyond just like the history you may have heard about the civil rights movement, because that was a minute fraction of what really was going on. Oh, and I forgot to mention this, but remember I was telling you all about how Andrew Young actually bailed out Fannie Lou Hamer and June Johnson in 1963 from jail? Right. What, that September of 1963, public pressure, and by public pressure I do mean like black people, and also the fact that the civil rights movement was heightened. Dr. King had was like still out here giving his I Have a Dream speech. Okay, that had just happened in August. In September, of course, there's public pressure that's prodding the Justice Department to file charges against the sheriff, a state trooper, and three other police for depriving June Johnson, Fannie Lou Hamer, Annell Ponder, Lawrence Guyot, and a few other civil rights workers of their civil rights in the jail in Winona, Mississippi. Well, of course, an all-white jury acquitted the sheriff and the state trooper and the police officers. They acquitted them of all their charges in December. Of course. This is why when we talk about police, okay, we talk about the brutality. This is why we talk about the system. The system that upholds this bullshit behavior, okay? The system that has always upheld it. This is why. Again, it's not new. So, what happened to June Johnson? Well, she kept fighting the good fight. She kept on. And, I mean, she eventually stopped working with SNCC because SNCC later dissolved, and she also was a paralegal for North Mississippi Rural Legal Services from 1972 to 1973. But throughout the 1970s, she was actively involved in lawsuits aimed at stopping racist practices of Greenwood City and LaFleur County governments as named plaintiff and as paralegal investigator. With Marion Wright Edelman of the Children's Defense Fund, June drew attention to failures of Mississippi anti-poverty agencies and investigated Mississippi prison conditions. In 1978, she was the first black woman candidate for LaFleur County Board of Supervisors. She moved to Washington, D.C. in 1982 and worked in city government for the Office of Paternity and Child Support Enforcement from 1983 to 1986. And as a home hospital teacher. From 1995 until September 2006, after her health began to fail, June was a program monitor in the Office of Early Childhood Development and served as first vice president of the Washington, D.C. Ward 6 Democrats. She was a research consultant for the film Freedom Song in 2000, which is about was about Mississippi SNCC workers, and lead consultant for the documentary Standing on My Sister's Shoulders, a film documenting her civil rights activism, along with fellow activists Dory Ladner, Fannie Lou Hamer, Victoria Gray Adams, Annie Devine, Lawrence Guyot, and others. Additionally, June is featured in a documentary produced by American Public Radio entitled Mississippi Becomes a Democracy. June Johnson passed away at the age of 59 in 2007. I told y'all you needed to know who June Johnson was. I started talking about her in this episode, but you see how everything's connected in history? I'm sure you've probably heard of the Freedom Summer before. And if you haven't, well, now you have. You may have heard of Fannie Lou Hamer before, but never heard of June Johnson. You may have heard about SNCC, right? Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. You never heard about June Johnson. Maybe you never even heard about Fannie Lou Hamer. Maybe you never heard about any of this. And the reason why is because history is so whitewashed. And we're told about civil rights movement. It takes up maybe 3 pages in a history textbook in a public school. And that should be just the whole curriculum for like a grade level. I don't know how that would work because I'm not a public school teacher. I've taught college and loved it. But the point of me saying all that is, y'all, this is the history, okay, that you need to know. This is the history that you need to be talking about. This is the history that connects the past to today. So many things that I discussed about June Johnson and what she experienced and what other SNCC workers experienced. Didn't that sound like what's happening today? Right now? And so it's why people like myself are always screaming about the fact that this is nothing new. Okay, that this is nothing new. This has always been happening. And to a huge majority of America, we still receive eye rolls, right? And we still receive, oh, well, you're just not doing this. You're just not doing this. Or we've progressed so much and the country is better. Is it though? Is it better for who? Because if you say that it's better, what you're like the foundation of your word, quote unquote, better is just sitting around the racism and the white supremacy that you still want to perpetuate and to uphold, right? And I say that to people, they get real pissed off at me, but it's true. So yeah, remember June Johnson, right? Remember the spirit of this black teenager who, from early on, saw the problems, wanted to make a difference, had such a passion for it, continued to do it, even after, okay, she was almost beat to death in a jail in Mississippi, okay, where she was afraid. People don't just get up from that and just keep on going like they're not scared. She was terrified. Terrified. But she did it anyway. And so, say all that to also say, to get back around to the point, which I always get back to, of this is why when we talk about anti-racism and dismantling systems, people say that they're tired or they don't want to do it or it's uncomfortable. Yeah. I'm sure you having to unpack your white privilege and your white supremacy culture that you hold on to so much. I'm sure that's so hard. Yeah, I said it. Sarcastically, of course. But these are the stories, right? Like June Johnson's story that show the bigger picture, that connect the dots. That, I mean, June Johnson is connected to the civil rights movement. She was an integral factor. Like, she was huge in Greenwood, Mississippi. And I didn't mean huge as in, oh, and also, let me also get on this because I feel like often the older generation constantly wants to tell us, and I mean, I'm 32 years old, and they want to tell us, oh, well, you just need to do this. You don't need to do it that way or this way. Y'all, understand and know that teenagers and children, because also children, okay, young adults like June who were out here doing this, all right, there were people, black people, who were still telling them, like, they don't need to be doing that. And they did it anyway. It's nothing new. And that's what we keep pushing on, and we keep fighting, and we keep demanding change. And another huge thing with this is voting and remembering all the other things that were happening in the country while I was talking to you about June, right? I mean, you had the Freedom Summer of 1964, that same year the Civil Rights Act was passed. The year before that, Dr. King gave his I Have a Dream speech, okay? The 3-4 years before that, SNCC was started. Like, there's so much was going on. It was just in nationwide. And yeah, so I can keep ranting about this, y'all, and just keep talking and talking about it because it truly just moves my spirit and just continues to even inspire me. No matter how many times I read about June Johnson, no matter how many times I read about Julian Bond and Andrew Young and Fannie Lou Hamer and so many others, and some that you will, you know, more that you're going to hear about in this season. But no matter how many times I read about it and read about them, I never get tired of doing this work because this is the work. This is the education that needs to be happening. This is how we make a difference and how we change what's happening right now in our country. The same things that happen in 1964, the same things that happened in 1947, the same things that happened in 1955. So, yeah, June Johnson, y'all. Told you wanted to know her. As always, with every podcast episode, I hope that you took all of this away. I hope that you were taking notes. If you weren't taking notes, like, I hope that this moved your spirit. That's why I do this work, is I want it to move you. I want you to have the aha moments. I want you to be uncomfortable in things that I read because I want you to feel it. Because if you're not moved by history, like you're not feeling something, then you're not really listening. You're not really reading it if you're not feeling something and you're not being moved and you're not wanting to like scream or throw your book across the room. Don't throw your phone. I want to do that sometimes, but Apple out here trying to rob people with the prices of like iPhones. So I don't throw my phone, but I'm serious. As always, I hope that you learned something. So that's all for this week's episode. What a strong one to kick off season 4. I'm extremely excited about this season. Definitely look at the show notes. Go to my Patreon to learn even more about June and all the other educational content that I have on there, y'all. I mean, I give a lot. So, because I want you to learn and I want you to know all the things and to go out here and fight this fight that we're going to have to continue fighting. I'm meant to say something else about voting and I forgot, but because I was just had so many things going on inside my head. But yeah, voting. Okay. Voting, legislation changes, policy changes, law changes. That's what you have to keep in mind, especially with this upcoming election, y'all. Especially with this godforsaken election coming up. My God. Whew. But had to put that in there. Anyway, y'all, as always, until next time.